Okay, members, we now have a quorum. I'll call the meeting to order. This is a joint meeting of the Health and Human Services Reform and Finance Committee for the purposes of going over the Health and Human Services Omnibus Finance Bill. Chief Author, Representative Abler, is ready at the testifying table. And Representative Abler, as I understand, you want to pull through this, and then we'll take questions.
Sure, Mr. Chair. You should draw a crowd, and you can avoid a joint meeting, Mr. Chair. So I hope the people find it worth their trip. And I want to thank different people for their interest in this thing, the members for their work on this project, and for a whole lot of people in the audience, many of whom have talked to me anonymously about things they see in this system in their position as a staff line person at DHS, or as a person working in a nursing home, or as a supervisor at a nursing home, or as any number of different levels of people engaged in this topic, ranging from high-ranking officials to very not-so-high-ranking people in life. And if we're going to get out of here at the end of whatever time we're getting out of here when there's an agreement, many of the ideas we're going to have to adopt are going to be novel and new. When we had targets in the past of $300 million, we could do some rate cuts and do a couple shifts and get out of here. The end target is going to be over $1 billion when the end game is upon us. I will predict that, and I would think you'd want to go north of that to actually be true about it. What that means is that nothing may be the same as how we do it. And as I've talked to the people in the audience, and probably half of you at least, and people listening at home, and people who have no way to get here and no voice but mine or yours to express those, they know that. And but I think the focus has to be on how do we serve the people who depend upon us. Some 800,000 people across the state touch in this committee in various ways, be it nursing homes or disability services or food supports or shelter or any number of things that we do to help them have a better life. Minnesota has long been a lead in compassion, humanitarian interest, and frankly, spending. And I make no apologies for that. It's my desire to continue that that trend and to make Minnesota a place that people feel secure in, that they can have a bad event happen, and actually we're going to look after them. On the other side, however, at least based upon the 40,000 people I represent and the others I've met from other parts, we've never had a 3 years like this. I can't think of any family within the sound of my voice who has been untouched by the events of the last 3 years. And I don't care who's to blame, it just happened through a whole bunch of events. And there's plenty of arguments about which party did it, which one didn't do it, and to me that's not a productive discussion, because here we are. And so how do we put this puzzle back together to assure that the people that we find to have the greatest need and the most fragile medical and social conditions in terms of their, you know, how much at risk they are for having harm come to them in some way, how do we look after them, and how do we help them also get on a path to be independent like we think, like they would actually like to be? Some people cannot be independent, and we've had much testimony over the last few years about who needs our help and who cannot live without the services we provide. Okay. Some people can become a bit more independent, and if we encourage them. I'm looking at now almost my sixth teenage son. Some of them need help to become more independent. But some people and some people in our systems need a little encouragement. And some people need a path to be led down and encouraged to seek a better way. And so the work that you'll see that I presented last week in partial, and now you'll get the spreadsheet, and the updated one will come later, is about that. How can we help our seniors be as independent as they can be? How can we help our people on waivers? If they can be more independent and have a better life, shouldn't we help them go that way? The people who are in a shelter, shouldn't they be encouraged to reach out of there and to become independent or more independent if they can be? If you're incapacitated, if you can't function, my desire is to see no one come to harm. That requires some careful work some serious discussion, some looking at everything. And I will tell you, one of my biggest frustrations in this process is that many people, many of the occupants of this room, would like nothing to change for their particular slice, while everybody else has to change. And it's my goal that people who have essential needs and important needs will be well cared for and safe and advancing to the, in the model Minnesota has become known for as a national example of how to do it and how to care. And so if I love my sons, I make them do all they can do. I make them pick up sticks in the yard. I make them read a book. And they still have time to play. And that doesn't fall all the way through with the, but that's because I love them. And so you'll see those themes throughout, and it's meant to be with a humanitarian flavor. So with those, I'm going to go through some of the highlights of how we went about this, and many of these are the same as what you heard on Wednesday, but I want to repeat them because different people are here. This is the official presentation of the bill, and we'll have a public testimony tomorrow starting at 8:15. If you wanted to sign up, you need to get all, or is that already expired? But anyway, so Christine's handling that. There's quite a good crowd. So we won't be lonely if you're afraid of that. And we'll go until everybody has a chance to make their say. We're going early to give more people the chance to do that in the light of day, and we'll come back after supper if we have to. Anyway, you'll have to forgive my pointedness, Mr. Chair. No one has ever had to do anything approaching reaching a target of $1.8 billion in retrenchments. I want to remind everybody that, however, that we are still spending $500 million more than we spent in general fund. And so we're not broke. It's just time to be frugal. It's time to be focused. It's time to focus on outcomes. And so, and just frankly, the state and the feds have long been denying this. The federal government is spending like money is growing, not even on trees. I mean, they must have a big bush where they have like pods of money. They're $1.6 trillion in deficit. 41 cents or more of every dollar is borrowed. Upon that, we build $12 or $13 billion of our budget out of 24 or so. And this is not a real sustainable source in my view, and maybe you'd think differently, but there's been a change there. And some of the new members there are uncomfortable with the level of spending we're at. They can't agree on $6 billion of changes, and there are $1.6 trillion in deficit. So, and if you read the forecast, I didn't bring a copy with me, but the state forecast, which was put out a few weeks ago, end of February, said that we had improved our budget by $1.2 billion. All is well, don't worry. Oh wait, read the text. It says fragile in there. It says be careful, handle with care. And it bases its projections on a few things. We've made some progress. Jobs are on the rebound to a small extent, and thank goodness for that. That's the way to get out of here, is to rebuild our jobs economy, rebuild the small businesses, get out of the way of little entrepreneurs trying to start their business. But it also says that oil is going to be at $100 until 2013. The forecast came out on Monday. On Tuesday, oil spiked above $100. So beware. They didn't know that Libya was going to have a big eruption and we're going to go to war with Libya. Like, whoa. That was not in the forecast. And that's a discomforting thought. And the disruption of oil and all the trouble over there, which, you know, God bless those people. For heaven's sakes. Nobody foresaw a tsunami in Japan, and the earthquake and the tsunami and the nuclear thing. How does that not affect us? And so if we continue on thinking the world's going to be the same, you are absolutely naive to think it's going to go like that. And so if we didn't have a target the size of ours, we should have a target half that size just to make this be sustainable. Because the simple hand puppets are, expenses are going here, revenue is going there. Last time we had the benefit of backfilling with some stimulus money, which was passed on a bipartisan basis from Washington, and it backfilled temporarily. And we said, oh, everything is fine. We shifted some money, $50 million to me, thank you very much for that, which we had to find a way to get that money this time on top of it. And so, and we keep backfilling, we do some rate cuts, oh, that's fine. Pretty soon nobody can see the people we care about. Those 800,000 people can't find a doctor who will take them. This to me seems like not a good idea. In my bill, I attempted to avoid rate cuts, and I didn't quite succeed, but I got close. And I'll go over that. But if the people in the audience and the people listening, monitoring in their rooms and their offices, think that the world will be the same after we get out of session from when it was last year You are wrong. And help me to do things a different way to serve the people we care so much about, make the money go a little further. And one theme that you'll come across is my managing level and need. We talked about that. That is probably the heart of my proposal that's different, whether it be medical care, disabled care, nursing home care. People have a level of need that they absolutely have. But some people, like in the thermometer, I set my thermometer at 69 because I'm trying to say, we're pretty warm. And some people think 65 is okay. And some people like their house at 75. Well, that's all right if you're paying the heat bill. But I'm going to tell you, if you're trying to save money for that household at 75, you'd say, you know, that's a little warm. You know, I think if you were take it down to 70, you're going to be pretty comfortable. You won't die, certainly. If it's at 40, we might have some issues of hypothermia. And that's the idea behind my managing level of need. And across the state, different counties, different well-intended public health nurses, social workers, healthcare, social, human service departments have given very disparate levels of need awards to people with similar needs. If we can bring those down to 70 degrees, nobody loses their life, their happiness, their productivity, even their good life that they have. They just don't get to be quite so hot. And I'm convinced if we do it that way, we can actually manage this without cutting provider rates, without turning anybody away, and with making the system sustainable so it can continue into the next 20 years. Because right now, we're on a four-year track to have this whole thing collapse. Anyway, so I don't apologize for the long thoughts, but I think it's important philosophically to set up for how I see this. The Senate will come out with an entirely different view. The governor had a different view. And I have a lot of regard for the governor. I've talked to him twice in the hallway. I'm looking forward to longer meetings sometime. I've met with a lot of his staff, the lieutenant governor at length. And I have a lot of hope that as this moves along, they're going to engage in this at the right time. It's too early for him to engage. It's not to their level yet. We haven't got a bill off the floor, and there's not a conference report yet. But I'm confident that they will come and help us do some of this work as well. But I want to remind you, with $4.1 billion to spend, the good governor, who has a heart bigger than mine, reduced human services by $800 million. With $4.1 billion. There's not a person in this room or in this building who thinks we're going to get $4.1 billion at the end of this session. And you can argue what the number is going to be, but I tell you, it's not going to be that number. And if a governor as good as him can change the numbers to $800 million, which is about half my target, with that much money, you know this is a matter to be discussed. And so the final target is somewhere between $800 and $1.8 billion. I don't know what the number is. I hope it's $800. I would love that. And we could do some great, nice reforms, and it'd be almost like business as usual for most people. So help me out. The bill you're going to hear today and Wednesday we'll talk about and Thursday we'll mark up is not ready to become law. It's the first time in my experience I've heard an author of a bill of this nature sit here and tell you it's not ready to become law. Why is that ready to become law? I'm glad you asked. Because the people in this room are not ready for the changes to happen that have to happen to make this, to hit the target that we have to hit. And that's met with respect. You're being dragged along into a surprise situation that you now need to understand is real. And so in this bill are multiple placeholders for more discussion. If I haven't affected your arena, I'm sorry, I missed you somehow. if you didn't get hit, just be quiet. But I'm insistent that everybody look at better ways to do business. And when I go through, I'll point out some of these things. There's some things in my budget that I'm going to ask people to vote for, to move off the floor, to create a discussion that's long overdue in some of these areas. Just to move on here, I'm open to all advice at most hours of the day. I'm going to do this, then I'll just do the overview of the things, and we'll talk about the money. I am convinced that one of the best units of government in this state to run social services is the county. There is no other group more poised, more geographically dispersed. There's one everywhere. And more interested in the welfare and the quality of life of their people. There's no other entity so staffed with quality people at the line level and the leadership level to understand their particular local needs. And you'll see in my bill a lot of work toward pushing counties to become service delivery authorities for which they would get great flexibility and I think be able to serve more people with the resources that will be left for them to serve. County-based purchasing, I think, is a good model. I think we should have more of it, at least to set the benchmark for what business should cost and how effective it could be. This is not a bill that bashes HMOs. I think they provide a great benefit to our state, and at the end of the day, we're still going to have them. HMOs understand the world is changing, and they need to adapt as well. I had a meeting today with the CEO of Blue Cross. He understands he's pushing change at Blue Cross. I was very impressed by what he talked about. I've been impressed by my meetings with other health plans as well, all of whom are white hat, good places, good citizens of ours that help us accomplish our task. We need to get the best out of them and the best out of the counties and the best out of the community health clinics, the best out of our providers statewide as we push everybody toward higher quality and better outcomes. I think some tribes need a chance to run their own circumstances. White Earth is especially well poised to do that. And in my bill, we give them freedom to run their own stuff. We're trying to find a way to even do their Indian child welfare programs in Hennepin County, which I think there's language in the amendment that helps that to happen. Health disparities are on my mind, and they are on all our minds. We care. This room is concerned and wants health disparities to simply go away. I've sat through discussions for 13 years listening to people who cared. We threw money at it, and they get worse. And we've designed them in my eye. And frankly, I am not the person to design a health disparity program. So I don't have the cultural competence in my background to know what would even work. So in the bill, we're trying to help people who are of the cultures, helping to take that competency to deliver it to get changes. And I won't go into more detail than that, but in the Merck changes, you'll see a push toward living flesh changes about doctors, nurses, therapists who would be of the culture that they would serve to really make a dent in this, and I think it can make a difference. The mental health system is a mess, with all respect, and the people who work in there are the salt of the earth. I have met, today is AFSCME Day at the Capitol, and some of the MAPE and SEIU people that scatter throughout all these systems. They're wonderful people. They're dedicated to their work, and they are being driven crazy by policies and lack of policy that we have set at from all levels of this state. And in one of the things I do, I actually close the CBHHs in the second year of the fiscal budget. Why? Because they're terrible? No, to create a discussion. I hope none of them close. The governor suggested closing one, and I guess that's all right. I have no idea what the best way to do is in the mental health thing, but I can tell you it's a mess. And I can tell you that the people who go in the front door, go out the back door, sometimes they wind up in the Dorothy Day Center. Really? How is this a system? And then they hang around, and they get put in sex offender prison because they had a bad day, and they were just, you know, in a bad year or whatever. But so, and prisons are full of them. Really? Is this the way to serve the people that have mental health issues? And so I thought that by repealing those, that would create a discussion. Let's talk. We have a great new deputy commissioner, Commissioner O'Connell. I wanted to give her some impetus to have the conversation, to give her some legs behind that dialogue. Because what I've discovered, if I sat here and gave this nice talk to people and had my points of view without language, you'd say, oh, what an interesting meeting Jim had, and, you know, good for him, and he went off again on all his thoughts. You put a bill together, people are talking. And so language moving through the legislature gets people to converse. And if I inadvertently hurt somebody with language here and I didn't know it, please let me know that. If I did intend to push you to a dialogue and you don't have the dialogue, then you are at risk. You might get what the bill says. Find me a better way. The waivers. If you look, the tales of some of the people on waivers are just compelling. I have met many, many people in my district and around who have, through just circumstances of life, be it an accident or birth or some disease, have found themselves in just a terrible spot. And the level need determinations, however, have made this program grow greater than it should. The people think, once, and the vendors, bless their heart, have not been pushed to have greater effort to give people a discharge plan to help them become more independent and to move these individuals on the path to the most independence they can have and to have options in the community. This bill gives options. It gives push toward greater level of need. Some people could become quite independent if the vendor would encourage them to be so. My intention is that 6-month intervals, people who have any chance of becoming either lower level of need or more independent will get an evaluation to decide both level of need and is this the right vendor. The times when they camped out at one vendor for their whole life and then that they got inflation to take care of that should be gone. It's not productive. And do we care about the people? Yes, as a room we care. So help me to care. Nursing homes are very fragile, and it's been my effort to minimize the impact on them. And in the amendment coming Thursday, you might see some additional changes in how we soften the blow on what they're... So we've tried to give them flexibility from regulation. I've tried to do some rate compression to help the ones at risk of being closed. And in the bill, you'll see, just so you understand, it's not an across-the-board change. It's a 95-5 compression. And it's an idea. You know, if too much harm happens to the ones getting the most money, then if it's inconvenient, I'm less interested in if absolute harm happens, because the one at the bottom, ones at the bottom, are in great danger of not even being able to serve. And so what we do specifically on that is take the top 5 percentile, reduce the rates by 5% at the most, taking out the specialty ones like Courage Center and other ones that have high needs, because those are atypical and they need that money to take care of people from dying and to keep them served and protected. And we add that to the bottom. And they would only go up 5%, and that would probably go up to the lowest 6 or 8%. And that's my idea about that. Mr. Chair, you had a question?
Yes, Representative Murphy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abler, I am happy to wait with my point until you're done walking through the bill, if that's easier for you.
As you wish. Would you like to answer a question on the topics? Because that's fine. Go ahead. If you want to give something.
Well, Representative Abler, thank you, Mr. Chair. We're at that point in the session where the budget work is going to begin in earnest, right? And we definitely have different perspectives on how to solve this problem. That part's really clear, right? That's, a lot of what the last election was about. And I know that you are taking, I think, a very honest approach with how you're talking about this legislation and what you want from everybody in terms of discussion. But there's something that has been repeated since the start of session that I just want to respectfully disagree with and ask that we not talk about it that way anymore. So over the last 4 years in my tenure, with the exception of one, we have been cutting the Health and Human Services budget. We've made deep cuts, honest cuts. They were in the bills. The people that were in this room knew about them, and Minnesotans knew about them. And we've done a lot of reform. And in this proposal and in some of the things that we have seen, some of those reforms are continuing with a different spin, but the same conceptual frame. There are pieces of that in this legislation. So while I understand that you are the new chair and have great deal of respect for that, I don't think it is okay to erase the last 4 years of work and to say there's been no work done, no cutting done, no reform done. And so I would just ask that as you are continuing to describe what you're doing, that we not edit what happened over the last 4 years, especially when the legislation that we see so far doesn't have as much in terms of cuts, but just concepts. I've been waiting patiently for this. I've been waiting to understand how you're going to do the 1.6, because there were a lot of people who campaigned over the summer and fall saying, government's too big, I want a smaller government, we're going to make cuts, we can do it without hurting the disabled, we can do it without hurting the elderly. I'm still waiting to see that. It's not quite here yet, but I get the discussion. Yeah. But I don't want any more a revision of the history that happened over the last 4 years, so I'm respectfully putting that on the table and asking that not happen again. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, actually, I agree with what you said. And I don't think that I'll criticize the last decade. I'll criticize the last 20 years. And it's nothing on you. It's but we have not dug into the forecast and to see what we're buying. We have done some rate cuts, and we've done some reforms, and I'm building, frankly, on the reforms. We do more with healthcare homes. We do more with care coordination. We do more with pregnancy care, building on the good things. And if I was on, I'll apologize to you publicly. If it seemed like I was saying nothing good happened in the last 4 years or ever, some great things have happened. So kudos to your 4 years of work that we can build on. And so I didn't mean that at all. So, and I'll, it's a fair point. And So I'll try to be less zealous about that if I can do it nicer. And my point is not so much to you, I don't think, but my deep frustration, if I have a deepest frustration of all, it's the people that kind of give me a wink and say, "You're taking care of me, right?" I was like, "Really? I am taking care of your people that you serve and that you care. You tell me you care so much about. I'm not sure if you're going to be all right, whoever the you is." And at the end of the day, much the same focus you bring as a nurse. Isn't it really about, there's a hospital and you got to work there. And all, but at the end, what drives me in my work, and I shouldn't speak what drives you, but would be compassion for your patients and helping them make a difference in their life to get well and to move on and to interact when you have time with the family. And so I think my point is that over my 13 years, I'll impugn bipartisan lack of digging on this. I'll keep it at that. We have lost sight of that in the name of protecting some vendors. So, you can't do that. Even lately, I'm having to react to that. And it's nothing about the last 4 years. It's about how it is in the legislature. Anyway, so I'll do my best to focus my comments. In the healthcare world, we've talked about this at some length. I don't want to repeat that a lot. I've been in discussion with the HMOs, and some are actually coming on board with this, at least thematically, about how we can go after the providers who keep the thermostat set at 75. There are some people, if you go in to the hospital or the clinic, Dr. Johnson, mythical Dr. Johnson, is going to do a lot of tests. And the staff knows they better allow time because they're getting lots of tests. See Dr. Smith, also mythical, you're not going to get so many tests. They just know that. And in just talking to Blue Cross today, their trend in their commercial market is 2.5%. Their trend in the Medicaid market is 7 or 9. Really? Well, and in the commercial market, they actually raise rates to providers. It's the same, they just don't manage it much. And so it's time to manage Medicaid. It's time to manage providers who know how to bill without impugning the character or anything about the 70% who are earnestly trying to do cost-effective quality work. And half those ones who do that don't even know they are because they haven't been told. And half need to be told they can't do that anymore and we're going to take their money away. An example in the bill, there was concern about C-sections before 39 weeks. That we all agree it's a bad thing. If you do a C-section at 38 weeks, you're going to have just a ton of nursery and maybe some neonatal stuff, great costs, greater harm of birth defects, greater harm of some waiver need later in their life. And so we say kindly, oh, please don't do that. And we say in our committee, we can say in our bill, go ahead and do it. We're not paying for it. That, to me, is a more direct way to get some change that we want. And so, I'm almost done with this part. We do more use of community health clinics, more healthcare homes, learning from the lessons of the CCDSs while trying to learn from the pitfalls of those, more county-based, more step therapy before elective surgery, which everybody agrees, not paying for repeat tests, which the commercials don't. Also in the bill, I suggest that we reorient some of the functions of the Department of Health and Commerce and DHS. And I've had some good meetings with the departments, which provokes the discussion I'm after. And it may not make sense to actually get people in a moving van and haul them over to some other building. But in this world of technology and everybody has a laptop, and people in Alexandria can talk to people in Rochester handily, like they were right there, we need to have more streamlined function. I only took the governor's administrative cuts. Didn't go deeper. So I don't know if they can even handle those. But if we have to tell them we have to get rid of some staff, we can help organize that staff into a better way that actually streamlines our work. Child care is intact. MPIP grants are unchanged. The community action program, CCSA grants are intact. Mental health grants are intact. Provider rates are generally stable. And the point of this is to reflect our priorities, create some reform, and create sustainability. So I'll go through some of the highlights. And I think just people are eager to ask some questions. I'm not going to drag this out very long. You all can read. But I'll go through the spreadsheet real quick, Mr. Chair, and then I'll stand for questions, and we can discuss specifics that people want to know about. If you go to page 1, the amount of money The target you see on line zero in the House column is 163727. That's our
target. Members, we're on the spreadsheet,
yeah,
which should be in your packet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anyway, so that's the target, a billion six and change. The all agencies just below that is $1,781,000,000. That includes healthcare access fund changes. And the number just below that is a general fund impact is $1,655,000,000. We actually had some good news on one of the HMO fiscal notes that brought us, ironically, $30 million, a different $30 million. And we're not allowed to capture the UCARE money because that would violate its gift status. So that's too bad. I would have liked that money. Anyway, in the healthcare access fund, we reduced by $158 million. And so there are some buybacks I have to do, which I'll report on Thursday, about maintenance of effort, and that'll be coming. So just to go through it maybe in 5 minutes, on page 2, line 81, you'll see there's the $6 million in general cuts. And where we follow the governor, I won't emphasize it much. We there was a whole series of things that happened between 1999 and 1999 and 2006 about some Minnesota Care work with Chair Bradley and Senator Berglund that got hammered out in a bipartisan agreement that were repealed along the way. There's a number of those that got added back in. So line 131 is one of those. Line 137 is Representative Huntley's bill. We also include the Purcell bill. That's on later, I think. Representative Fritz bill is in here about InReach. The Erdahl bill is in here with that nursing home of his. The next thing is the Lanning bill on line 143, which is the circles of supports work, trying to help people get on the path to success. And we found some money for that. We took the governor's work on EGA, and we did the child support grants. I did not reduce the community action grants. Kept FAME around. That's only one more year, but we kept that. We did change the family child care rates by 20%. Let's see. On the next page, which is line 4, the difference is we did nursing home rate equalization. The language in the bill is the full equalization, and that actually costs money. You can see in the tails that there is a cost, which involves increased need that they anticipated some, I don't know what rate they imputed that would go up for the locals, but they imputed some rate, probably a couple percent. In line 280, we repealed the PCA alternative, a non-implemented program that hasn't been implemented yet. We did the waiver, and there's a maintenance effort question about that, which I have to adjust that number by, I think, $84 million to bring it to March 2010. The rest of the page. We suspended the property rate adjustment for nursing homes. That was a freeze. There's no cut there. There's the non-rate payments. That's the governor's number minus the single bed. We took that out. That was controversial and problematic for some rural providers, I understand. There's the blue flat thing on line 346. Dental therapist is covered by both of us, which I think is a great idea. Example of reform. And Mr. Chair, I should just comment about that thematically. There's some professions that have a hard time either being enough of serving the groups or there aren't enough of them to go around. And I think this dental therapist piece that we did a couple years ago, which was also a bipartisan work, is really something we're going to be proud of. But I think it's an example where we can create another level of licensure that's not as high to serve some of the essential needs of groups. And there may be some other groups like that we should address about how they maybe could come to evolve. Having done a lot of work with licensing, I understand there's always controversy with those. But I think the result of this is going to be some wonderful access for people that are of very low income and high needs. Enough about that. Let's see, the address of the page is just governor's stuff. Line 419, which is on page 7, we eliminate some health care grants. Those are Youth Special Kids has closed, I understand. So we took that money. We're actually working on a high cost. We're working to institutionalize, or that's not, to permanentize the benefit of Youth Special Kids using Children's and four hospitals are going to work on that. I forget which four. Where they're going to try to care coordinate. Maybe it's the U. Anyway, there's four of those that are doing that, which is going to be a wonderful thing to help these very fragile kids to get some management. The global waiver, I'm sure we'll talk about that later. Just have an inkling. call me psychic if you want. Mental health payment. This is a thing which probably will create good discussion. Line 435. This is an example. This is the higher rate, 51% higher if you're a mental health counselor at a community health center, which I have great affinity for, if you didn't know. I think they're stellar. If you work at one of those, you get 51% more money than if you work down the road at a private provider. And, you know, it seems nice. Well, they have a higher cost. I'm trying to support some of their costs later in the bill. But what happens is the privates take great umbrage at this. And they don't want to see patients, so they think it's unfair. And having heard from some of them, I put this in. I didn't know the impact would be quite as high as this. But we need to talk about how do we get more people to be served by private vendors as well as the ones that are, I don't know if CCHCs are quasi-public, but the ones that are heavily subsidized like this. And that's meant that will discuss, bring some discussion. So I say bring on the discussion. And so I want to cause no harm to the CHCCs over this, but I do need to have the discussion. So there's a few things like that besides. DHS fee for service, this is more the healthcare stuff we talked about before. Healthcare grants, we give a little subsidies. This is part of the stuff that came from Mike Scandaret's group. Emergency medical assistance, we modify that.
On to page
8. See, if you go to page 490, Mr. Chair, you have a bill you're quite fond of. House File 8 is on there. And that saves money in the healthcare access fund, generally. And the rest of that page is either the governor or we're not doing their changes. In the line 538, I couldn't avoid reducing MRC funding, but I just reduced it by half. So the MRC funding is we took the surplus money and just took half the governor's cut on that, with a lot of reform pushing it toward health disparities and deep rural and isolated. And I'm trying earnestly not to cut it, and that was the last thing I did, Representative Huntley, just to get to what I had to get to. And it's not my interest to take any money away from anybody. And if I could restore that, I would. But I absolutely want to change how that money is spent and make it focused on outcomes. Because right now it goes, and it's well enough used by the institutions, but there's no focused product of that. And so if we can help get some health disparities met by doing that, I think we're going to be better off in the long run. High-cost providers, we talked about that on line 553. 570, the governor, in his original proposal, took away services for single adults over 200% of poverty in Minnesota care. That has since been rescinded in his latest version. And to get the healthcare access fund anywhere near balanced, I had to do that for only 2 years. So it's a suspension, not a termination. So that those services are restored in 2014. The other numbers vary some. The governor's numbers now change with the repricing, and so some of these will be different in our fiscal note. Eligibility reviews is and the on line 603 and line 615. Those are some of those other changes we talked about. The Healthcare Access Commission, we took the $100,000 that got us, because I don't, you know, it's nice to talk about healthcare. I think we can do it as well as we can here and bring in all the people. I think it's a better process. I don't know why the numbers are different on line 624. We have less of the savings than the governor had. That might be a repricing thing. Because we probably took the early enrollment. We took the 200% and above. That's why that would be a lower number, because there's less savings. Then the transfers are what they have to be to make everything balance. We have less transfers than the governor does. And then The line 660 is the closure of Wilmer and then the state operated service sites in the second year, hoping to create a discussion. There was a carry forward from MSOP, and we also there's some work going to happen on this whole sex offenders topic, and I think it's due. I know Senator Hann and Senator Berglund have a proposal they're working on. I'm eager to be part of that. It turns out that and they create kind of a triage to who gets to be put in, which I think is prudent. And this is a placeholder for that discussion. And it's definitely a cleaver approach compared to something, more soft. But this says that the counties who would commit somebody would pay 30% of the share of new persons so committed. And so it puts some of their skin in the game, so they think this person is worth us paying money on. I'm not sure 30% is the right number, but it was an effort to create that discussion, which I'm already having. Like I say, you want to get a discussion, you put money in a bill, and they're talking to you. And we gave MSOP 1 year of their budget increase, pending more discussion with them. And so we wanted to show respect for the program and the state employees working there. 7-Eleven, we did some healthcare access fund reductions of some of the transformation ongoing work. We don't undo anything, except that I'm concerned about some of the data that goes to the Department of Health. There's an advisory committee on patient health that came out of the health disparities work that we funded $50,000. Merck inline 731 is the Merck surplus. And then we took only half the cut on that, and that's with apologies. And I think the others are things we didn't do, and the end of it is just the health-related boards, and those are the monies they requested. They have a proposal to want to receive and appropriate their own money. I personally am uncomfortable with that. I think it's better when they have to come to us and keep some level of connection to us on a biennial basis. There is a provision that I would like to do, which is where we segment better their money in the special revenue fund. So, Mr. Chair, I've talked long enough, and I will then yield to questions about specifics in the text, which I'm not going to go through, unless people want to ask about a specific thing. So I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Members' questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, question on the spreadsheet, and maybe this would be more for the House fiscal staff, but how much of what's in this spreadsheet is not fiscal noted? How much of this is just, numbers that are not official numbers from MMP?
Ms. Chair, I know a lot of Mr. Walls can give you the latest. I know we're waiting on some fiscal notes, but he can give his best update of what the numbers are.
Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the spreadsheet as it is before the committee currently, there are several issues. And first of all, let me say that updated spreadsheets will be coming along throughout the process that include fiscal notes with either a savings or a cost that we have yet to receive from the department. There may be some language changes in a author's amendment that may change some of the numbers that are represented here on the sheet. And you will also see changes to numbers both in the governor's column and the House column, because the governor's updated budget is not in only his original budget, and there will be some repricing by the department for some items that were originally priced to the November forecast and now will need to be repriced to reflect the February forecast. With that said, there are items here that are a reflection of taking a savings against forecast, and those numbers are accurate to the appropriation change versus the forecast. However, we are waiting for comment from the department, and those would be there's the waiver proposal is still a work in progress, and also the global waiver, which is a number in the sheet that is backed up by the authority of the department to impose rate cuts, has not received fiscal notation from the department. Or and I've been told we are going to be receiving some memos with DHS opinions or concerns on a few items in the bill, but we are still waiting for that at this time.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler. And, you know, with that, so there's quite a bit in here that we're still waiting on, and you've been very open about talking about how this is a work in process. But I think it's important, though, that we just make it really clear. From what I understand, the delay in this is not because the department hasn't been responsive, and I think that from what I have been told, some of these things have come, they've been coming in sort of very late in the process, and I just want you to speak to that, because I just want it to be clear that to the extent that there are things in this bill that are not yet priced fully, that that's not the fault of the people whose responsibility it is to price them out. So could you just address that, please?
Representative Liebling, we look like Kilroy to each other here, I think. Maybe we can spin the chair just so I can see your nose is sticking out like this. And probably mine was, too. It's awkward. Yeah, Representative Hayden's a little taller, so I can see all of him. So, and it's a sight, I want to, Mr. Hayden. Yeah. and actually, and I you have not heard any complaint from me about the speed of fiscal notes. The whole process is speeded up. We're a month ahead of where we were 2 years ago. That was delayed, actually. There was a two-week, I think the deadline was something like 2 weeks beyond now for the deadlines in the regular human services bill, and it was delayed because of fiscal notes. And so so we are definitely moving at a fast pace here, and you're correct to say that. But the department has been diligent in trying to do the best they can. Mr. Walls gave them a triage about how they should, and they've been very faithful about that. That being said, at some point you're going to have a discussion about some assumptions they're making, with which I do not agree. And that'll be a discussion for Thursday. And I'll disclose those when I see all the assumptions they're making, when they write them down. And part of my talk was about that, to help people understand that we need to move beyond some assumptions and look at a new way of doing business, built on the good, Representative Murphy is gone, but built on the good ways we've done it in the past that we have learned from, because we have made great strides, you know, before. So, that'll be part of that discussion will be for Thursday when you see the new spreadsheet, and then you can, it'll be more nailed down then. And does that help?
Representative Liebling?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Abler. And, you know, from what I understand about some of this, I guess we'll have a full discussion of what the assumptions are that are in this, but I've noticed in your bill that in many places it seems to just tell the commissioner to figure out how to do a lot of stuff. And I don't know to what degree they're going to be able to actually price it out and say what costs or savings there might be when there's so much left undefined in the bill. And I think that's going to be a real challenge here, because I think that when members vote on a bill, I mean, this is a very unusual process. I think we all see that. It is speeded up. The speeding up is entirely self-inflicted by your leadership, and there is a reason that things move at the pace that they do. The public doesn't always see that. But there is a reason, and that reason is so that things can be done in as careful a way as we can do them, because we are, after all, in this committee, we're impacting real people who need real services, sometimes services to keep them alive. So this is real stuff, and we need to make sure that when members vote on something, that they know how it's going to impact their constituents, who, after all, that's why they're here, to make the best choices for their constituents. So I just, I'm very concerned that a lot of things in this bill, although, you know, I respect the challenge that you have, and this isn't about you as an individual, obviously, but the rhetoric has been that we can just cut the budget. And people ran saying, we don't need more revenue, we can just cut the budget, that there's waste, fraud, and abuse. And of course, one of the things that I most object to is the mythology that's often out there in the public and pushed by mostly people on your side of the aisle who want to say that somehow welfare is responsible for our budget problems. obviously there's very little welfare in this bill. The cuts are not to welfare as such. This is the trajectory that we're on here, I think, is very problematic. We're trying to, I respect your desire to think of creative new ways to do things, but we have to do that in a process that allows people to weigh in so that we actually know what we've got when we vote on it. And this idea that we're going to vote on a bill that we is going to be kind of half-baked is, I think, is really problematic.
Mr. Representative Abler.
Well, I appreciate the dialogue. Let me just give you an example of interesting fiscal notes. One of my local nurses, who's stopped in on Nurse Day, was chatting about PCA things that they can and can't do, and she says, you know, they can't do any rehab, like anything, and like they're barred from that, and not like they're going to be a therapist or something, but they can't do anything that resembles that. And I said, really? So I put a little sentence saying that they could do some rehab. You know, that creates, you'd be amazed how, and so it seemed prudent to me if they're there anyway and they know what they're doing and that's part of the care plan, that they could rub on someone's elbow in a certain way or help something, but oh, can't do that because it's not, it's considered rehab. And so they were charging, I never heard the number, but it was going to be a large number, they said, and they a large number of them would be large because they deal in all these zeros all the time, because it was going to open up the door to all kinds of more rehab services. And like, you know, I just meant that if while they're there in the same hours, if they met with the OT person anyway and they know how to do something for their vein stripping or something that otherwise they couldn't get, that they could rub on, do something that would be safe and while they're out there. Because a lot of times the PCA has like busy times and then 3 hours of just keeping them kind of company. And so if they could do something else while they're there, we would save an OT visit that they don't even get paid very well to go to. And let people have more benefit from this. This is the thinking I'm going through. And so you'll see an amendment in my bill that shrinks that way down to say just this little tiny piece while they're there. And but that's an example of how you don't even know what you're getting into while you try to improve things. But I appreciate your concern. So that was just an example.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more thing on that. Representative Abler, you know, that's those attempts to improve things are admirable. However, the process for that is you put a bill together, you submit a bill, and the bill gets heard by a committee, and people come in and testify just on that change. And here we're just taking so many of these things and just tossing them out there. We don't have that process. So, you know, that may work very well. On the other hand, there may be lots of things that you and I wouldn't think of because we don't do that work. And here, what we're doing here is trying to push all this through. And, I mean, we always feel like we're drinking from a fire hose around here, but this is drinking from 10 fire hoses all at once. And nobody can do that. And so I am afraid that we're going to do, if your bill were to become law, and I know you've said it isn't ready for that, but if we adopt this kind of process in this legislature, God help us.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I was wondering when we start talking about fiscal notes, if you could let us know the date at which they were all submitted, each individual one, to the department. And I have a million questions, but I think I'll just do two on one topic. And you talked about preventing C-sections, but the bill only relates to induction of labor before 39 weeks. It has nothing to do about C-sections.
Representative Abler?
Well, I see an amendment coming. What page is that on, just so I can make
That'd be page 127.
Okay. Well, that's why I tell you my intent. And to your first question, I have no idea when any fiscal note was submitted. The staff does all that, and I have no personal connection to that process. So I can't answer that question. And so I'm going to, what line, what page is that C-section thing, Mr.
127.
Okay. Maybe if the correct staff would note that. It was my intention to not to have that. So. You'll see an amendment to that effect, Mr. Representative Huntley. What was your
Representative
second?
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, if you could have direct your staff then to tell us when each of these was submitted.
Representative Huntley, I understand that they'll need to look that up. That information's not ready to hand. So we can have that looked up and get that information to you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, since we're talking about pregnancies, on page 151, you're talking about pregnancy homes. And would you know, and you say limited to 300 births the first year and a threshold of 500 births per year in the second succeeding year. Would you have somebody look up the number of facilities in this hospitals in this country that have, in this state rather, that have 500 births per year? I think that would be an interesting topic, because I would guess there are practically none.
Representative Abler.
Actually, that paragraph's taken, is going to get taken out for the very reason you raised. So just to the word about the pregnancy home. Dr. Stephen Calvin and former Representative Maria Rood and others have been working on this with a number of others. And so some of the, that's what that comes from, and they've been, we've been getting all kinds of advice about this, which includes deleting 151, line 17 to line 20. So good observation. Thank you. And that'll be in the author's amendment on Thursday.
Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair, that's it for right now.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering if someone from the Department of Human Services might be able to give us just a little more information about fiscal notes. And the reason why I ask is because we are ahead of our usual schedule, and I know how hard it is for the department to turn information around. So before we get into a finger-pointing about who is not doing what, I thought it would be good to get on the record when you got language, when you got fiscal note requests, so we just have that information for the committee. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Chuck Johnson, the Chief Financial Officer for DHS. Mr. Representative Murphy, I don't have specifics on when all the fiscal note requests were received related to what's in the bill. Some of the items that are in the bill released yesterday were items we hadn't seen before, so there are some that are new that we're now just getting our first look at. And many came last week, but I don't know the exact numbers or what days they came on. We are in the process of trying to identify that per the request you'd made to the commissioner.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson. And I think it would be helpful for us to know when we should anticipate the fiscal notes that match the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it's certainly our intent to try to get as much of that information ready for Thursday as we can. As Mr. Walls said, some of the items that are in the spreadsheet need to be repriced, some need to be updated to the forecast. There are others where we have a fiscal note that may be one version behind on the language we need to get the update. And those are all items that we're working on. There are several items, as Mr. Walls and Representative Abler referenced, where we may or may not be providing a fiscal, maybe provide an analysis about why we can't come to a fiscal estimate on the particular language that we see in front of us. And we're also working on those items to identify what we can and can't figure out about what the cost would be based on the language that's in the bill.
And Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Murphy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I'll just close with this. I think so the reason why this is important is so that Minnesotans can understand the impact of what we're describing in this legislation. And if you don't have a clear, one of the things you learn through a really clear fiscal note is the impact on the number of people, et cetera. We get a lot of good detail out of those notes that come to us. It helps us evaluate. It helps Minnesotans evaluate. So I think it's important to have this information on the record. I appreciate the hard work that people are doing. I urge the department to get us as much information as they can when they can, knowing that it's difficult. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abler, I want to say thank you for bringing the budget forward. I know that you have talked to a lot of people and have done a yeoman's job and has even taking a meeting for myself, asking for things around people who are homeless, are long-term homeless. So I want to thank you for that work. I think it is definitely admirable, and there's a lot to look at in this bill and trying to make kind of sense of it and tying it to the fiscal notes. The one piece I wanted to talk to you a little bit about was a piece of policy that you put in here. I think that was Representative Dalt's bill around the EBT card and the EBT card restriction. So I don't think it's any wonder that I would want to talk about that just a little bit. And so the question is, it kind of connects to the fiscal notes. It's policy, but it looks like it's going to cost us something if we wanted to do all the things that Representative Dalt's bill says it wants to do. So I guess I just want to know, have we requested the fiscal note, and is it coming, and do we know how much it costs?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I have the privilege of carrying that language in my bill, and there will be a line item representing that. And maybe Mr. Walls can comment on it. I know we have to pay for it somehow. So.
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, that bill, I believe, was amended in committee, and they made some changes to the bill, I believe, last Tuesday. That was the day, I believe, we put in a request for the amended fiscal note. However, the language was sent to the department, I believe, in a PDF file, because the engrossment, there's a delay with which the official engrossment is put up on the web by the revisor's office. There's some kind of motion that has to take place on the floor before they can post that. So when they began work on that, I'm not sure, but the note was requested about a week ago, I believe.
Mr. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. That's good information. That sounds like we may not have our number before we probably have to vote on this. So that, to me, is somewhat problematic. And it's kind of going down the lines of Representative Leaving, Representative Murphy, about trying to understand, you know, I have a lot of issues with the impact. I think that it is, I'm kind of surprised, Mr. Chair, because we've talked a lot about this, and maybe there's pressure from your caucus to put this in. But And the reason why I say that, Mr. Chair, is York County in particular has one of the best fraud analysis groups around the state at detecting fraud in our Minnesota Investment Program and other safety net programs. So I know that you talk to them a lot, and they do a phenomenal job at looking at if there is fraud. And so we have that infrastructure throughout the state. So not only am I a little surprised that you have it in the bill, because your county does such a good job, but all the counties do a good job, that they really detect this. And so I'm all for reform, but when reform is needed, in this particular case, there doesn't seem to be an issue with reform. I always note the legislative auditor the first year that I got here saying that he's got some problems in DHS. We're dealing with PCAs and others, but welfare, if you will, which I really don't like to refer, but for the new members that aren't familiar with the acronyms that we use for the welfare programs, the Minnesota Family Investment Program is not one of them. And so when I start to look and go through the bill and see all of the things, for instance, that someone who is on Minnesota Family Investment Program, who gets a small benefit in order to pay their rent, maybe pay their child care worker, maybe buy food for their family, or maybe things that aren't food, such as toiletries, would only be able to get $20 in which to do so, and then would have to find another means in which to pay their rent. I'm not sure how many folks that pay their rent have an ATM card that they could slide it through. So that just seems to me to be just kind of an overkill. The other notice, the things that I saw is the residency requirement, which we'll go into this, but there is tons of evidence in case law that talk about residency requirements. And so if we put that in law, I hope that the fiscal note would reflect how much money we would have to spend, take as legal aid as they would do, take this to court. I could go on forever, and I don't want to waste the committee's time, because we have a ton of time in which to try to fix this, because I think that we're going to have to. But I just wanted to make a comment that I think it's important that we get down to real work, we find real savings, we do all some of the great and innovative things that you want to do. This Representative Abler isn't one of those things. This is something that I think is, like I said, a little surprising, because that it made it into your bill as opposed to it going as a standalone, and then we can argue it, you know, on the floor, because I know you know how much infrastructure we have around this issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
You know, and it's too bad to take a perfect bill and otherwise create one mar. I think this is an area that is worthy of more discussion, and I think it could use some improving myself. And so it's carried in here, if only to create dialogue, and I think it's already accomplished dialogue. And if I had to rate things on a 1 to 10 level that I think are important, this wouldn't be my number one thing, I'll tell you that. So I think that, and with the pieces in the bill, you know, they're in there, and they're worthy of discussion, but if you notice how we treated the whole MFIP program and our efforts at that, this is something that that a lot of people want to talk about, and so that's why it's there. And there may be some big net of this that can come out that makes sense, and I don't know which big net that might be, but maybe you and I can figure out if there's any merit in any of it to take into the law.
Good. And in closing, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I thank you for that. I think it is worthy of discussion. I think that we'll have a really good discussion about it. So one of the things that I think that we must do if we're going to get our work done here and if we're going to save money is to really understand what we're doing, understand what the programs that we are working on, the programs that we are looking to change, what they actually do, what are the rules and regulations to make sure that as we find new reform, like, for instance, your great idea about nurses maybe doing a little bit of rehab work or other things that people have told you, that we really listen to what this program does to people, how it helps people improve their lives, how it has the accountability measures, so that once and for all we can put some of these welfare myths to bed and really understand that it does do what it's supposed to do for people, especially a ton of people. We've heard this from the healthcare industry, UCARE. One of the things that they said that they gave us the money back is because so many people lost their jobs that they went to the public program, but because they had been doing really good, because they had been in healthcare, they found the savings. Well, one of the things that we find in the Minnesota Family Investment Program is those very same people are going on to this program as well. And so I don't know if by restricting the program to the extent that we appease our kind of local grocers who may see fraud or some sensational TV program that may show one particular person make a poor choice. I don't know if we should punish those folks that are trying to get their lives back on track with such, we'll leave it at that. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden, okay. Representative Slawick, Hosh, Fritz, and Huntley. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, it's interesting to hear my colleagues' perspectives today. Of course, it's our chance to talk a little bit about the bill, too, and we're just getting used to seeing what's in here. As far as child care and early childhood, which I'm the lead on for this committee, I wanted to ask a couple of questions. One, I was happy to see that you didn't cut the general appropriation or cut the rate or cut the exit level. We know that in 2003, all of those things happened. We also know that you talked about yesterday you're headed towards May 27th as the end deadline, so I hope you will continue. Or May 3rd?
23rd.
23rd, okay. Well, we hope you will keep all of that the same and not cut any of those. That being said, on page 2 of the bill, there is on line 2.6, it says the commissioner shall set aside 2% of the basic sliding fee appropriation. So basically a 2% cut to go to the AHIC program. And in talking with the department about this, and I forwarded this to you, Mr. Walls, and I don't know if you've seen that, Mr. Chair, but it's not an allowable use to use all of the basic sliding fee appropriation. You can only use the general fund part of that, which is about $847,000. So is that going to be changed?
Yeah. Representative Abel.
Mr. Representative Slavik, I just talked to Ms. Pinelli about that today, and we're going to incorporate those department changes that were suggested that would, I think, do that very number. Oh. 800 and maybe, so there it's going to be in the amendment. So does Ms. Pinelli want to comment on that, or is that just, we're doing that. So thank you for the observation. We'd like to avoid breaking federal laws.
Right. That's what, Mr. Chair, that's what I worry about.
Representative Slawick.
A lot of this bill is we need to make sure we're not breaking federal law and that we are following what's allowable to be cut and not allowable to be cut in this committee compared to other committees. There's just, as you know, a lot of this is mandated. My other question would be just below that, for as far as the unlicensed care, you do a cut from 90 to 64%, and I'm just wondering what your thinking is on that.
Representative Abler.
That would be, I believe it was 20% was what I thought we were doing.
Okay.
This is the family child care, and there are only a handful of rate cuts in the draft you have in front of you. There may be another one coming, which you'll notice on Thursday. We'll discuss that then. I don't want to, no point to get you all excited until then if I can avoid it. There's family PCA, where a relative does PCA services, and there's family child care.
Yeah.
So this reduces both those rates by 20%. Thinking that, you know, that hopefully they would continue on with that anyway, and that they're related, and so they're still getting a considerable sum, 80% of what they got before.
Representative Slawick.
Just last comment. So actually there are some cuts here, and it would be interesting. I don't know if we can find out how much $847,000 of the 2% or that appropriation not going to the basic sliding fee, how many kids on the waiting list that would serve. I wonder. I'm not really sure how many that would serve, but probably a lot. And then as far as the rate cut, we just have to remember in Minnesota we have a tremendous amount of kids in unlicensed care. We'd like to change that and give them incentives to get licensed, but maybe by cutting that will do that. But I worry. We just want to make sure that we know where kids are and that they're being reimbursed.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler,
and those are all fair points. The at-home infant program, some of those are women, obviously, who would have gone back to work, but for the fact they could stay home a little longer with their child. And so a lot of those are eligible already for basic sliding fee. It's an income. It's not like anybody who wanted to do it. It's a carve out of that program, and so it would let them stay home. It's an allowable use. So probably the impact, given the low rate we're reimbursing, might actually create more slots for somebody else, or at least it wouldn't adversely impact the number much, if it at all. So maybe there's a few people that would get ahead of the waiting list at the worst, but it may actually, because it's less expensive, it might actually open up a few slots. So I don't know.
Another, we'll end with that, but we can continue to talk and debate about that.
Help, yeah.
Thank you.
Very good. People are digging into the bill. See you already. Okay, very good. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler. I apologize if I'm repeating some questions beforehand, but I had to step away. I have a household of strep, double ear infections, and pink eye. So,
how many people in the room here can relate?
Houses.
Show of hands.
Which is why you're sitting by yourself.
I apologize. Representative Hosh, you have the floor.
It's our spouses go through a lot with what we have to do here. So thank your spouses when you get a chance. But I was talking to my wife about that, so I apologize if I'm repeating anything. But Representative Hayden was asking questions when I came back in the room, and Mr. Wall said that some of the fiscal impacts on the EBT cards weren't currently tracking in the spreadsheet. So I was wondering what items do we have right now that isn't currently being tracked in the spreadsheet that's included in the language of the bill?
You want to have Mr. Walls answer that, Representative Abler?
We did talk about it, but I think if you want to just give the short thumbnail, Mr. Walls, if you don't mind, just to...
Mr. Walls. To
Hosh. Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, I've been in contact with several different program areas within the Department of Human Services as well as the Department of Health, and have been told that there are many items in each of the areas that may have a fiscal note. Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you what that number would be, only that if there are certain costs that may come forward to us from the departments, there may be an author's amendment or language change to take out that cost or implement the language in a different way that may change the fiscal note, have a savings, or something of that nature. I'm aware of about maybe 6 to 8 issues in the continuing care area. There are several in health care, and there's 2 or 3 in the sort of the children and families area. Specifically to the MFIP area, there is the EBT card. We are also waiting on a fiscal note for a change to the allowable vehicle value. And I think there is a GA eligibility piece, and those are the ones off the top of my head that I'm aware of. I've been told by the Department of Health we'll be receiving a fiscal note that will have several issues as well.
Representative Hush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, we'll have time for plenty of discussion in the next days ahead, and I'll leave some of those comments for that point, but I appreciate the information.
That's an important point. We will have a lot of time for discussion. A lot of time for discussion. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Chair Abler, I just wanted to raise the issue of ask you why the full repeal of the rate equalization in nursing homes, and if you had also considered a cap on that. You know, it almost seems, have you ever thought you were born at the wrong time? I'm at the age where, you know, at 66, I get Social Security, my home is paid for, I have long-term health care insurance, and then I will have, you know, more money to pay should I or my spouse enter a nursing home. I'll go broke faster. And I with that repeal of that, much faster. I'd sort of hoped I could last, that my money could last me like we all think, at least 10 years. But, you know, with the full repeal, it just, you know, it really is hard for me to understand, and I just wanted to ask you why with the full repeal.
Representative Abler.
You know, I've worked on this topic for, I don't know, 8 years off and on, or since you've been here, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some ways to do some discussion about what other parts might make sense if we did some pieces. But just to keep the discussion going, I thought, well, let's talk about the whole thing. And so I provoked a question from you. I've had a number of phone calls. And so I'm not lacking for company. And so, but I think that the discussion is worth having. And I'm happy to work on it.
Representative
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you. That's
fine. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I have a question for you and then probably something for Mr. Johnson. But on page 171, which relates to the sole source or single plan managed care contract, it, the way I read this, I think it violates federal law. Federal law says that any urban county or metropolitan statistical area must offer a choice of plans to their employees, and this line 32 on page 171 certainly undoes that and undoes that, and I think that's still the federal law. It was last year.
Representative Abler.
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe this is part of the county-based purchasing work, and you know, I don't want to be hauled away in cuffs, you know, someday for breaking some federal law. So obviously if it breaks the federal law, then we don't want to do it. However, I did want to do everything I can do to encourage county-based purchasing to succeed. The very question that you raised, that I don't wake up thinking about it, but it's in the back of my mind. I've repeated it a dozen times at least to people, and I think about it. I talked to the CEO of Blue Cross this morning. I said, tell me your incentive to save money. And so that's why I'm pushing for county-based. If there's something that we just can't do, I'm happy to not do it. That's the idea. And so if we're told by staff that we've gone too far, then I'm happy to there. But my thinking on county-based purchasing, since you brought up the topic, is that there are a few entities better suited to handle the frontline work of coordinating the in-reach program from Representative Fritz. They would do that automatically. That would just be part of how they would do it. They would have every reason to do it because they would know the people, and they would, and they also have a reason to control costs. And if the benchmark cost of health care were to be determined, I would think it would be based on what county-based would come up with in terms of all their coordination, all their natural inclination to do things that we are calling, that we're calling new and novel. So any advice that people want to offer me about violations, I'm all for. Any ways to make it more flexible to do it, especially as a starting point, I think makes a lot of sense.
Representative Hundley?
Well, Mr. Chair, then I have a request for Assistant Commissioner Johnson on a different matter. And throughout this bill, there's lots of talks about coordinated care for people with chronic illnesses. There's lots of talk about medical homes. And the way I read most of those things, they're easing up the requirements to what is considered a medical home. I know that Minnesota is one of eight states that was awarded an advanced primary care demonstration project. And if we have a agreement with the with the federal government for that item about what a medical home is or isn't, and would this, if you could have somebody in your department look at all the things on medical homes and chronic disease management and see if they're in some way violate what is in our agreement with the feds on the advanced primary care.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, I will take that question back to the department and get you an answer on the connection between the items in this bill and the grant that you're talking about.
Representative Vabler.
Well, thank you, Representative Huntley. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that. And actually, I had the same question myself, which I have not yet had answered. My interest is this, and you've heard me say this throughout the whole healthcare home discussion, that you have these FUHCs and the community health centers, which have made a career out of serving people in the ways that we want our healthcare homes to do. And ironically, a bunch of them, at least until late, have not applied because it was too onerous. And because of the $10 to $50 they would get a month, or $10 to $60, average $30 to manage a case, was insufficient to handle the cost of applying. And so, when I put in here that they're deemed to be a healthcare home, I do expect some pushback from the department. But my interest and my goal is to make it as easy as it can be for those groups who already meet high standards. To serve the public in this very important way, which the hospitals have done with their level 3 CCDSs, and the ones who have become healthcare homes have already done. Now, the average clinic is not set up in this way. People come in, they go, they maybe have a nurse line, but they don't have people that follow up. And I'll tell you, the savings that the CCDSs and some of these healthcare homes have discovered is way beyond the $30 a month, but it's in the 20% range. And so that's my effort on this, and I appreciate you raising the point, and so we'll keep working on that, too.
Representative Hundley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler and Mr. Johnson, I just came across another one here, and on page 23, it says that basically small clinics don't have to implement electronic health records until 6 years after what our previous law said they should do. Our previous law says they have to have them up and running by January 2015. This one says, if they're small, they don't have to do anything on this until December 31st, 2020. That's a six-year delay. And I would like to know from somebody in the Human Service Department, I believe there's federal law on electronic medical records relating to MA and Medicare that also mandate that these be implemented sooner than 2020. And so if you could have somebody there also look that up, I would appreciate it.
Actually, Representative Huntley, I think that's Department of Health. I believe that's under Health, but we could have them look into it as well. Representative Abler.
Mr. Representative Huntley and members and the public, it's easy to pass a law that says to do something at a certain time. I have been all with you on electronic records. I think it's the way to go. I think if you're a big plan, that it's if you're a big organization, that to do that is it's economically feasible and you have people to do it. Some of the small clinics, you're going to be just surprised to know, are not going to be in compliance in 2015 because they haven't got the money. The hospitals who lose money that are at risk are the ones who hook up with a clinic that has been somewhat of a loss leader. If you're going to be in the business of serving a lot of medical assistance people and Minnesota Care people and even the commercial rates now, it's hard to even stay open. And so this is an effort to create a discussion around that. I'm not stuck on the date, but I am thinking that we need to be thoughtful and help not make these small clinics criminals and in violation of some reimbursement when they're the very ones that are the front lines of our work. There are some grants available. There was some ACA money. There was some stimulus money, I think, both pots. There's been some state grant monies, but far insufficient to handle the needs of these small clinics. And so if the dialogue doesn't happen here, where is it going to happen? And if we don't notice these small clinics, who else is going to pay attention to us? So this is the right venue for it. The date was, frankly, a plug date. But just to give them time and to call attention to it. It may even be that 2 or 3 years is enough relief to offer, and we'll find out what the federal standard is. If there's not, we should go as long as we can stand. Maybe submit a plan or something if we have to give them more time. That's the intention behind it.
Representative Hundley.
Well, one last one for me. Again, and that has to do with the legal stuff. Someplace in here, I don't know where it is right now, there's talk about rural pharmacies, and they get reimbursed more than or in a different way than other pharmacies. What I'd like to know is how you do that. Is that legal if you have a Walmart down the street in a rural community from a independent pharmacy? Is it legal for us to treat them differently?
Representative Vabler.
Ms. Chair, Representative Huntley, and I hope so. Because I'll tell you the problem. You tell me how you want to fix it. one of your own pharmacies just went out of business and got subsumed by Walmart. But I'll tell you, the pharmacies in deep rural and isolated parts of Minnesota are one of the front lines of access to medications for these nursing homes. Unless you want to turn the world, and I know you don't, but unless we as a state want to let the world be run by out-of-state the mail orders and have nobody in the face-to-face world, we've got to find a way to keep these pharmacies open. I'm from Anoka. This is not going to affect me in the least. I don't even go out in the deep rural isolated parts much, and it's nice to go and enjoy the fresh air. But people live out there, and they expect us to keep their services available. And we have sat through discussion after discussion for 4 years at least trying to find a way, especially when they changed the AWP minus numbers, which we've been doing for the last several years, and watching these places curl up and die. And this is my way. And so what the bill proposes is that we take 2% of the ingredient rate and give them a bonus for these, if they're isolated and or deep rural and they have less than 4 in their chain, then they would get this enhanced rate. I expect the cost to be around $1 million based upon runs we've done in the past. This is a way to shrink down to the most critical needs. So that's the effort. And if not this way, then how else? And I'm just deeply concerned. And when we have, in your gavel, we had testimony, if you recall, about the problem. So, and we all talked about it, and we couldn't find the money last time to do it, and I felt bad about that. And so this is my effort to do a smaller fix to do the most desperate need repair. So.
Well, and as I recall, Representative Abler, there were discussions with the Department of Human Services about this. So, Representative Huntley.
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Hey, Representative Abler, I have two specific questions about the bill. On page 98, there is reference to animal chiropractic, and I'm just wondering if this is what is being changed here? Is it just the fees, or is there something else new going on there?
Representative Abler.
This is not the puppy mill bill, Representative Murphy. And no animals were harmed in its preparation.
Would this make that
Representative
germane?
Murphy.
Mr. Chair, would that make that germane?
I hope so. I'd love to carry I get the EBD card, puppy mill. Well, let's just pile on all the good discussion things. We don't have dialogue. And then, how long do you want to be on the floor on this bill, Representative Murphy? This is simply part of the board operations for their fee, and they have to set these fee by statute, and so I guess they didn't have fees before, so I don't see a change, and the board language in here, to my knowledge, and my disclaimer is this has been worked on. Every board item has been in process in up to a year on some of this, and there are certain items. The nurses' standard stock bill has a thing about border states. I said, not in my bill. Pick a different bill for that. And so that's in the full bill, which will be tracking however it tracks. But they had some things that everybody agreed to about background studies and some other parts like that. So knowing this topic pretty well and knowing the sensitivities of, well, of the room and the members and the licensees and the entities there, I was able to shrink down to what I deemed to be non-controversial. There's some other work in the in here about boards and how they do their operations for investigations, which is now non-controversial as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative,
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That's just a new fee.
I'm not sure if it's new or not, but it's the fee they brought to us, and this all goes to the special revenue fund. There's no general fund. Just to get to that question, just to go a little further, there is no fee revenue in here. There's no any revenue. The only revenue that would be inclined to go to the general fund would be the co-pays on high-cost clinics like the... Our effort is with Deloitte's idea to have three tiers of clinics. Tier one has the old $3 copay. Tier two is six. Tier three is 10. Those actually are supplanted by the reductions of rates that would be paid by those clinics. So there's no increase in revenues that I have to spend. All this revenue that goes to the boards, they would raise and spend on their own activities, and it was supposed to reflect cost.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just one other question then, Representative Abler, and this is something we already talked about once on page 191. We talked about this yesterday. So 191, line 17, talks about, this is about the section about who's a Minnesota resident, and we add language saying other than a place of public accommodation. Is that, to what does that refer, and what does it mean in terms of residency, and would that include a shelter? Please.
Representative Abel.
Mr. Chair, I believe so. And Mr. Chun can go into more detail, but I'll answer it as well as I can. Then I'll defer to staff who knows more about this. This is a healthcare access fund kind of money, and even though I did reduce it to 200% of poverty, I didn't like doing that. I didn't want to go to 190 or other lower numbers, which is why I tried to scoop up small amounts of money to protect those yet on there. In discussion about this is almost a technical change, because most of the people in a shelter would be eligible for early MA, which this bill leaves. And so the impact was determined to be de minimis, and maybe Mr. Chun can go beyond that if he wants.
Thanks.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chun, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, this is language that was, I guess, removed from statute a few years back, and one of the effects was that it would then make, of adding it back, is that it would then make people who are, residing in a shelter, ineligible for Minnesota care, but I don't know the impact of number of people or whether they're other places that would fall in the definition of public accommodation. The main focus, I think, was on people in the shelter.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so either to Representative Abler, probably to Representative Abler, this is, is this something that we'll see with a fiscal note? Does this have much of a fiscal impact?
Representative Abler.
Mr. Walls might know there's a spate of these kinds of small changes, and I'm not sure if they're carried in aggregate. Or Mr. Walls might know what the latest on that is. If it's a savings, it'd be really small.
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I requested that the department, in order to perhaps speed things along or make things a little more organized process, that if they could first look at all of the Minnesota care changes that we were doing and reprice those first and then go on to other MA changes. I was sent a bundle by the department that was reflective of our changes for Minnesota care. That was not one of the items that came back with a cost. I was told up front that they would not be forecasting a significant cost or savings to that language change. I don't know if they intend to maybe follow, if that was an oversight and they intend to follow up, but I was told to not expect really any dollar savings for that change in law.
Right. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler, and everybody else. If there isn't a significant savings to the Healthcare Access Fund from this language, then I sure hope the committee would entertain removing this change.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vabler.
And Representative Murphy, that amendment would be certainly in order on Thursday. Part of what's happened, though, over time is a lack of simplification of our programs. And I asked Representative Loeffler and others to attempt to simplify our programs in order to create a more understandable way, and so the Minnesota Helpline could actually be helpful, and so we could somehow at some day automate all this. You know why HealthMatch collapsed was because of 14,000 decision points. This would make one less decision point, or maybe some number, maybe 5 or 10 with the different populations you might have. And so if the answer was right to MA, nobody would have to wonder, should I go to Minnesota Care or not? So that's another reason to keep it, seems to me, but we can discuss that when you make your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler. It sure seems to me that if somebody
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Needs an address to be eligible, then an address that is a place of public accommodation wouldn't be necessarily simplifying the system, but we can talk more about it on Thursday. Thank you.
Representative Flash.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy made the exact point I was going to say.
Memories, as was mentioned earlier, we will have a lot of time for conversation on this, and we certainly have more time yet today. So, questions from the committee. Well, I see no further questions, and having no other business before the committee. Yes, go ahead, Representative Liebling.
Yeah.
I should have said going once, going twice.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just have a process question for Representative Abler in terms of our amendments that, you know, as we talked about before, this is moving through very, very quickly, and there's a lot here that we've never seen before. And so I'm just wondering, again, I know I asked you before about amendments and what the deadline would be, and I'm sure staff is pretty overwhelmed right now trying to put amendments together as well. So I'm wondering if, you know, since we're going to be in committee basically all day tomorrow, it makes it very difficult to get amendments ready. And there may be amendments that people want to do based on the testimony tomorrow. So I just want to ask you again, if we get amendments in, say, at the end of business tomorrow or... I hope that there's going to be, since, you know, in this whole process, after all, there weren't bills introduced. We're working off amendments. We're going to be doing amendments to what essentially were amendments. I wonder if members can get those in late tomorrow and still have them be in order.
Representative Vabler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, if your amendment's not done by Wednesday sometime, the staff probably can't get it done. I mean, in terms of just logistically, their time to do it. I try to be a reasonable person, you know, and if it's to staff, in the morning by Wednesday, they can't get it written until late in the day. That's different than if you think of an idea at 9 at night and want them to try to conjure it up for Thursday. So, and you kind of, I will be surprised if you hear testimony that you discover changes your mind about something, although we're going to learn a lot when we hear 50 witnesses or whatever there. And, I think you know what, I mean, you know what kind of differences we have in our philosophies and what sort of things you might like to talk about, because this isn't the first time you've heard these topics. Not just even this week, I mean, in the last several years you've been on a committee with us. So it needs to be in the pipeline, I think. I don't want the staff working till midnight to do something we thought of at 9. I think that's not fair to them. So if you could do your best, maybe you'll think of something that we all like and it's like just a good idea and no one objects. That's different than a whole thing given to staff at 7 at night. So I think we should all do our best to try to get them done by noon. Like we had set out, and then we can talk about a case-by-case basis on things that we think of later. I think that's fair. It's how we've done it in the past. I know that in the committee, it was 4 years ago, we had a 24-hour rule. An amendment came out from the chair, which we'd never seen, and we had our amendments drafted to the bill, and the ruling of the chair was to disallow our amendments because they weren't drafted to the money that we had, that had been changed. I don't intend to do that. But there's something in the middle where it's reasonably done, and the discussion of this bill will continue far past Thursday. There'll be ways and means. There's the floor. There's there's an outside chance the governor won't sign our first bill. There was rumor to that, and I hope that he signs this bill. I hope he puts something together and he says, there's a lot of good stuff here. Let's get this done and move along and get done by May 23rd.
Members, I would also point out, just for clarification, we went over the major components of this very legislation. Granted, this bill was not available until yesterday, all laced together, but we went over major components of this almost a week ago. So we have had time to look at most of what's before us today over the last week. And as Representative Abler has pointed out, there will be additional time. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to respond, Representative Abler. I mean, this, while there are obviously there are big philosophical differences about this bill and the direction we should be going with regard to our budget and whether we should be cutting people with disabilities and cutting people who are elderly in order to balance our budget, This bill makes a lot of changes, as I said before, that would affect real people and their real needs. So I think that for you to say that we're going to hear all this testimony and that we're not going to hear anything that's going to change our minds, that is rather surprising to me. And, I hope that this isn't going to be, presumably this bill is about more than philosophies. There's a lot of policy in here that we do need to hear from people about, and I hope it will change our minds because we don't know enough about what's in this bill and how people think it will affect them. So I think that testimony is very important, and I hope we are listening to it, and I hope that, if we think right now that it's not going to change anybody's mind about anything, what's the point? I think we all need to know how this is going to affect the real people that we're affecting in this bill.
Mr. Representative Abler.
I didn't mean it that way, and I just, you know what I meant, and it didn't work out the way there's four messages, when you say something. Is it what you think you're going to say? There's what the words that come out. There's what you hear, and there's how you interpret what you heard. One of those four messages wasn't what you heard. So, if ever we're going to get a bill that can get us out of Dodge or out of St. Paul in time to enjoy Memorial Weekend, which is my absolute goal, it's not going to happen if I don't listen to Representative Liebling and take your good advice and the rest of the people like that and the people in the audience and the people who trust us to get our work done. So that's my commitment. And so did that sound? Was that better?
Very good. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler. I know you put a lot of heart and thought and agony, I suspect, into putting this together. And I maybe am too much of a process person, but as someone who sits on the policy committee and not the finance division, and there's quite a number of us here around the table, it's been disappointing that some of these major policy choices and the discussion around them wasn't able to happen in the policy committee with extended, thoughtful give and take from all the stakeholders, including the state agencies that will have to implement it and the people whose lives will be affected by it. And I know that because you're given such a difficult, large target, that you took the time you needed to try and figure out how to get there. But for those of us who sit on that committee, I'm disappointed that we haven't had a chance to see them in bills with standalone hearings and hearing from all sides, because while you talk about the discussion and this is the start of the discussion, it sounds like a one-on-one discussion with you instead of people of goodwill from both parties sitting around a table listening to thoughtful input and detail, because we know every single one of these hundreds of pages do have impacts on lives, and I most appreciate the process when we have a chance to do that. So I just wanted to say that I think it's important that we all listen, whether to the testimony tomorrow, and that it really does have an influence to have us understand going forward what that means and what we need to back away from. And with that, I just want to say I think that when we can, we ought to really honor the process and bring things through the policy committee, in even if they're unformed ideas that may not get into the final bill. And we've all introduced bills in the past, those of us who served before, with good ideas and good intentions. And, you know, after the discussion in the policy committee, it doesn't get into the final bill because there's some issues that need to be worked out and they're just not ready for prime time. And I think this process would have benefited from more of that kind of time, with sort of not quite totally baked ideas being able to have more time in the daylight.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Abler.
Is tomorrow's meeting a joint meeting, or is it just the finance? But I think it would be my desire that that reform members are welcome to attend and to listen. And so we're starting at 8:15, and so we're starting in the Capitol tomorrow, right? Capitol 118 at 8:15. So you're more than welcome to come, and you know that I respect your ideas a lot. So,
Representative Abler, it is a finance committee only, but I would extend that invitation as well to reform committee members. There's no reason they can't be there. It's open to everybody. Representative Hosh. Okay, members, you should hang on to the materials you have today. We'll be going over those again tomorrow. Additional copies will not be made for Thursday. If you absolutely need one, it's broken, you've written all over it, you want to change it, make that request maybe after committee today. We could get you another copy. Representative Abler.
Well, just on the same thing to the public, if you were here today and got one, please don't get another one. They're 300 pages long. If somebody, we're going to have a few extra copies made for tomorrow and Thursday, or just for people who didn't get one. So just try to save a tree. Thanks.
If people have, you know, on the other side of that, if you have materials you no longer need, you have a new copy, please recycle those as well. Turn them back into the pages. Tomorrow, as Representative Abler pointed out, Wednesday, March 23rd, 8:15 in the morning in room 118 of the Capitol, we begin taking public testimony. Members, we will spend hours and hours open to public testimony. So if you want to hear public input on this bill and the things contained in it, tomorrow's the day. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I didn't realize... Thank you. I didn't realize we were meeting in the Capitol. I totally get it. I didn't realize, so I'm just curious as to why. We didn't have...
Representative Murphy, we did not have the room available. So once again, just to be very clear to anybody watching, listening in the room or elsewhere, it is room 118 of the Capitol, the State Capitol building, tomorrow morning at 8:15. I'm sure if you arrive and you thought it was here, somebody will be glad to direct you over there. We'll be there for a very long time.
Can we come to the...
Representative Abler.
Then is it the basement? And then at 12:30, Mr. Chair, we'll be going to the basement of this building for at 12:30.
Okay, so again, because of the room situation, we start at 8:15 tomorrow in room 118 of the Capitol. At 12:30, we will move to the basement hearing room in the state office building at 12:30 tomorrow to continue to take public testimony on this bill. Members, if we know the business before the committee, we stand adjourned.